More test, 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 test. Test, 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 test. This is an interview of Leonard Lyman for the SEC Historical Society. The interviewer is Richard Rowe. Mr. Lyman is being interviewed at the offices of Proskauer Rose at 2 p.m. on Friday, February 27, 2004. Leonard, could you give us a little bit of your background and how it came to be that you ended up at the SEC in the 60s?
Certainly. I was a partner at a law firm in New York called Revis and McGrath in those days. I worked with a senior partner named Howard McMorris. McMorris is a good friend of Manny Cohn's and also of Milton Kroll, a prominent Washington lawyer. And good friend of Manny's, former colleague at the SEC. Manny, when he learned that he was to become chairman, wanted someone who knew more about Wall Street than he admitted that he did. An occasion of modesty to be noted, and it was, I think, a false modesty because he knew plenty about Wall Street. But Milton spoke to Howard. I had a couple of transactions with Milton on the other side, so that they both knew me well. They approached me on behalf of Manny. I had a quick meeting with Manny, and it was, I think, love at first sight, and we made a deal. But that's how I got there.
And you became the executive assistant to the chairman at that time.
The job was as executive assistant to Manny Cohn. It was his first executive assistant since he had just become chairman. The job was not terribly well defined. It was clear that Manny wanted me to be with him a great deal of the time. There were some regular duties that we had, like congressional correspondence and making sure that the commission agendas were in order. But Manny knew everything about the SEC. He didn't need me for the routine stuff that much. I sat in on virtually every meeting he had with an outsider. If I was in the office, I gave speeches. If he didn't want to give them, he would send me out to make a speech. There were lots of specific things he gave me to do, but I also had a very free-ranging portfolio. If I thought I could be helpful, I would just go out and do it. Sometimes I would tell him, sometimes I wouldn't. It was generally somewhat ambiguous with the person I was speaking to, whether I was there with the chairman's authority or not. In the few occasions where that was challenged, where Manny always backed me up.
Were those external meetings or meetings with the other staff of the commission?
No, that was meetings with the staff. I think it might be useful to describe the commission as it was then, because it's considerably different from what it is now. There were of course five commissioners then also. The other four, three of them were about Manny's age. Hugh Owens from Oklahoma, former Blue Sky administrator. Hamer Budge, former, I think, five-term congressman from Idaho, and a former judge. Their interests were rather narrow. And somewhat parochial. Hugh Owens cared that the Blue Sky administrator's jurisdiction was protected. Hamer Budge cared that small broker-dealers were not discriminated against. The other two commissioners were different. The senior commissioner was Barney Woodside, a former director of the Division of Corporation Finance. In fact, Manny succeeded him in 1960 when Woodside was appointed to the commission. Woodside was a very, very considerable person, devoted to the SEC, did all the work, did his homework very carefully, very close friend of Manny's, on a personal as well as a professional basis, and I think was an important part in Manny's total construct of handling the commission. And the fifth commissioner was quite different from everyone else. That was Frank Wheat, who came on board about the same week that I did. He was considerably younger, a dozen years younger than the others. The only one with real law firm experience, large law firm experience. He came from a large California law firm. And he came to the commission with lots of energy and wanting to do a lot of substantive work. Unfortunately, that was not Manny's vision of what the other commissioners were supposed to do, and that's a story in itself.
Yes, as you probably know, I eventually became Frank Wheat's legal assistant.
True.
But it was a year or so after the time you're speaking of.
Well, I say it with a smile on my face, but I suspect the experience, at least at the beginning, was a little frustrating for Wheat, because he wanted to do things, and he was certainly capable of doing them. But Manny was a man who believed in consensus. He wanted things smooth and easy and running the way he wanted them to run. And he would, knowing that Frank had energy and wanted to do things, he would think of things for Frank to do. And it really didn't gel terribly well until really the very end of my tenure, when I think it was June of 1966, George McCaley, who had been the chief counsel of the Division of Corporation Finance, decided to try to fill a gap in the registration provisions of the 33 Act. There was a Rule 133, which created a big hole in the registration and resale of unregistered securities in the system, and he produced a large, dense, complex set of rules that cured the Rule 133 problem. The difficulty was that his bosses, Worthy and Bagley of the division, didn't support the project. He somehow got it to the commission anyway. It was plainly going nowhere, but Manny gave it to Wheat to make it his project, see if he could do anything with it. It eventually evolved into the Wheat Report and Rule 144, which solved a somewhat different portion of the gap in the securities laws, and achieved a great deal of publicity and success for Frank Wheat, which must have given Manny a little bit of a jolt, but it worked out rather well in the end. So that was the makeup of the commission. The SEC itself was different. The big division was Corporation Finance. There was no enforcement division. There was trading and markets, which dealt with the broker dealers and the markets. Corporate regulation, which dealt with investment companies. The chief accountant and service personnel like Frank Donnelly, who was the controller and had the budget. Heather Pollack had the division of personnel. Ably led divisions. There were good people leading them, but the times were different. Things were really much simpler. Take like investment companies, for example. When I was there, I think it was $40 to $50 billion of total assets in investment companies. Today there are $2 to $3 billion in money market funds alone. I think it's $7 trillion of investment company money now. The New York Stock Exchange would trade a couple of million shares a day. Now it's in the it could be a billion shares, certainly hundreds of millions on the average day. The world has changed a great deal since then.
In those days, Leonard, did the regional offices have more power or isolation power than they do today?
My sense of it was that everything went through Washington ultimately. I once was sent out to Cleveland to give a speech. Cleveland was, I think, a branch office rather than a regional office. Manny didn't want to give the speech to a society of securities analysts there, so he sent me out, and I, of course, stopped in at the branch because nobody from Washington had been there for years. And I was, frankly, appalled at what I'd seen. There were boxes of stuff from Washington that had never been opened. That was supposed to be in a public reading room, but they just were never opened. I don't think the regional offices were that significant thing.
Well, they thought they were, at least.
Well, and there were personalities who led them and who were significant and met in Washington regularly. I don't mean to diminish their importance, but there's a centralist tendency then in the regional office.
Yeah, I think you're right in saying that there were personalities there at some of the regional offices, so that one's view of those offices were probably colored by who the regional administrator was at the time. You're right, the commission was much different in those days. The staff of the chairman has grown considerably since Manny Cohen's time. And how many people did he have in his office in addition to you?
Well, we started with me, really, and a couple of secretaries, quite both of them quite able. But Manny came into office just after the special study had been completed. And the Securities Act amendments of 1964 had just been signed. It was, in fact, signed on the day that Manny took the oath of office. Those two pieces required a lot of implementation, tons of rules and rulemaking required. And, for example, one of them was 12G, which required registration of securities that had a trading market, whether or not they'd ever had a Securities Act registration. That pulled in a lot of foreign companies, and that was a problem. And we, in the chairman's office, borrowed a young lawyer, Jeff Bauman, who eventually became full-time in the office, but we were borrowing him part-time from the Division of Corporation Finance, and he worked quite heavily on implementation matters. So that was maybe three quarters of a person. And then there came a time a little bit later when the decision was made that we needed another full-time lawyer. Jeff was pretty busy with implementation, so we were looking elsewhere. And by then I had a lot of friends around the building, and I asked around for recommendations, and the name came up, Richard T. Byrd. Well, I looked him up on the organization chart, and there was a Richard T. Byrd. He had a closet of his office. I think it had a window, but just barely. He worked alone, and it had a he had a title that was something like chief file clerk or something. It meant nothing, the title. Where I interviewed Seberg, and he was just superb. And I went to Bob Bagley, who was the associate director of the Division of Corporation Finance and certainly the chief operating officer of that division. He had his fingers on everything. And I went to him. I remember the conversation very clearly. I said, Bob, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to borrow somebody full-time from your division. And he said, that's too bad. We'll be sorry to lose Jeff. And I said, not Jeff, Dick T. Byrd. And he turned red and half rose in his chair. And he said, quote, how did you find Dick T. Byrd? Dick Seabrook came on board, it was a terrific addition, stayed, did other government work afterwards, and eventually practiced law. Unfortunately, died quite young.
And you mentioned the implementation of the 64 Act Amendments. There was actually more to that than just the registration of these over-the-counter companies.
Well, sure. I'm just thinking of the things that required manpower from the chairman's office. I might say that at some point early on in the work, in my tenure rather, Manny had a quite serious heart attack. This came fairly early. I'm not sure when it occurred, but I had been there long enough to certainly know where the men's room was and to know a lot of the people, but it was pretty early. I didn't have certainly a complete grasp of the commission. But the chairman's office, the structure in those days, everything came to the chairman's office. There was no executive director of the commission. The chairman was responsible for personnel, budget, operations, promotions. Everything came through the chairman's office. Manny was out for 4 months. In the beginning of that, a fairly long period, he was totally out of communication with the office. Woodside, as I said, was quite devoted friend of Manny's. We sat down, and he said, there's going to be a commission here when Manny comes back, and it's going to be well run. And without any statutory authority that I know of, Woodside, as the most senior commissioner, simply assumed the central chair of commission meetings and ran the agenda of the commission. And I, in my immature ignorance, did whatever I could in the chairman's office to keep things going. The congressional correspondence and important correspondence kept getting handled. In fact, there was a book on the broker-dealer regulation that was written by a staff member, which was destined to be published imminently. And Manny had promised a foreword, Manny wrote a foreword while he was incapacitated, signed by Manny Cohn, which gave him some pleasure, I think, after he discovered he had written it. Some things were mechanically difficult. If an income tax return was required as part of an investigation, that required a signature of the chairman. Somehow we solved that problem. I'm quite sure I didn't forge the chairman's name, but somehow the chairman's office requested and got income tax returns when needed. So we improvised an awful lot, but bless him, Woodside ran an awfully good commission during that period, including some important things. For example, the Texas Gulf Sulphur case was decided while Manny was out of the office.
There also was I guess Manny was there when it was finally completed, but there was a big study that was done during this tenure, or at least completed.
The investment company staff?
Yeah.
The study was completed, and it plainly contemplated legislation. There was an interesting attitude toward legislation in those days. Today we seem to get statutes every session of Congress. In those days there was very little legislation, and the commission was afraid of legislation. The theory was that if you went to Congress and asked for something, you never knew what you were going to get, so they didn't like to ask. When it was clear that there was going to be a legislative program, this is one of the things I did on my own. I went to Sal Friedman, who was director of the Division of Corporate Regulation, which included investment companies, And I told him that I had noticed at commission meetings there were some cases that were roadblocks to regulation. They didn't challenge cases. If there was a district court case somewhere that went against them, they'd live with that case. They didn't try to do the same thing in another district and get a contrary decision. And I said, well, if that's the way you're going to behave, how about legislation fixing the problem? Friedman absolutely would not talk to me about it. He would not contemplate asking Congress for anything. So I went around him. I went to other people for suggestions. This is something that built up and was completed after I left, but we did get some legislation out of it.
Yeah, the legislation finally came out in 1970. But I recall when that study had been submitted to the commission, my recollection is that Manny was not happy with the way it was drafted and presented, and he sat a group around in the commission meeting room and said, "You're not leaving until this thing is satisfactorily drafted."
Well, that would have been typical behavior. But most of the time, the consensus building, he liked consensus, was done privately. There was no sunshine rule in those days. By the time something came to the commission table for consideration, it had been pretty well worked out. It was very rare that there was a conflict at the commission table, and I don't remember any dissents really until after that original commission didn't fight with each other at all.
But it was much easier in those days because, as you mentioned, there was no Government of the Sunshine Act, and commissioners and staff members could get together informally and discuss things without putting a notice in the Federal Register and having a meeting open or tape recorded for everybody to hear.
That is a huge difference.
It is a huge difference.
But Manny, if somebody really didn't like what he wanted and he was convinced that he was right, he would simply say, we have to do this. If not, I'll resign. You'll have to get yourself another commissioner. That's his line. And somehow he managed to work out the consensus. Now, that might mean changing his position. He was not afraid of picking up somebody else's idea and working it into what he had started with, particularly if it was necessary to achieve that agreement that he wanted. Not always, but not infrequently. He was not his general intellectual makeup was part of that. He was extremely intelligent, had an excellent memory, could be quite intuitive in terms of making connections and creative in terms of making changes that would satisfy people. And he was a hard worker. He would he would work hard to achieve that that agreement that he felt was a better way of conducting business. He also had we really haven't mentioned a really excellent group of people around him. Some of the names I've mentioned. Bagley and his boss, Ed Worthy, Ralph Saul and Irv Pollack in Trading and Markets. There's some wonderful people and younger people, Gene Rothberg, Mike Eisenberg, Alan Mostoff. I'm just picking names out of the hat, but there were loads of very, very good people. Some left over from the special studies, some new hires. There always seems to be good senior management and a steady flow of bright young people at the commission, which made it a delight for me to work there, and of course meant that the level of the commission's work was at a very high order.
And Manny, if I recall, was I guess I could call him a hard taskmaster and strove for excellence not only himself but in those that are around him if he wanted to. The best work product that could be produced.
Uh, he he didn't mind work. If it was necessary to redo something, there was always time to redo it. And that fit my law firm training, so it was a good match for it. I didn't mind. Even though we didn't have computers where you could make changes easily, we're still working with carbon paper. I've mentioned the Texas Sulfur case before that this came to the commission table while he was away. One thing that wouldn't have happened had he been there was that there was a clerical employee in an assistant secretary's office somewhere in the administration who was mentioned in the, in the complaint, and the White House was a little miffed that they hadn't been warned, not that it happened, but that they hadn't been warned that it was going to be happening. That was part of my learning process. I wouldn't have missed that a second time. Lyndon Johnson was the president. He did not. He was very supportive of Manning. He liked Manning. I don't remember any interference from the White House at all on anything other than support. Washington in those days was full of my contemporaries. One of the things that attracted me to the job. This is part of the Kennedy heritage, I suppose, but not entirely. One of the friends was Joe Califano, who was Johnson's advisor on domestic matters, chief advisor on domestic matters. He was a friend from New York, and Manny and I went over to see him and worked on him to include a line in the State of the Union message, which was a consumer message. We convinced him that the SEC was really a consumer agency. We got a line in the message, and Manny was very pleased with that.
I recall that during Manning's administration, there were moves to divest the commission of its authority over public utility holding companies. And were you there at that time?
Well, that... Yes, I don't think he would have minded that, frankly.
My recollection is that he was ready to... Lee White was then the chairman of the Federal Power Commission, and he was ready to absolutely assume all of that responsibility.
One of the other things, thinking now of the wonderful staff I mentioned before, one of the things that we did during... I think we did, the chairman did, and I helped with during my 2 years was... A staff reorganization. I learned a lot then about how personnel works and budget works. The Division of Corporation Finance is the glamour division. It had plenty of people and plenty of able people. And the Division of Corporate Regulation was limping somewhat. And the device to cure that was to take the registration aspects of investment companies, which, because it was a 33 Act function, was in the Division of Corporation Finance, and moving that to corporate regulation with the rest of investment company matters, so that all investment company business would be done in the one division as it still is today. To do that meant you have to move people from corporation finance to the corporate regulation division. They have to be selected, and Harry Pollack and Frank Donnelly at personnel and budget had to make sure that those changes got made. Now, it sounds easy, but I mentioned Bob Bagley before, and believe me, it was a negotiation with Bob Bagley. He was wonderful. I remember there were two persons of similar names in the Division of Corporation Finance, one of which we badly wanted to move over to corporate regulation. And every list that ever got produced somehow those names got confused. It was the wrong one. And it would be pointed out to Bagley, and he'd say, oh, I wonder how that happened. It would be corrected, and then it came right back again. But we got the right one in the end. And I remember, I did some proselytizing. I remember talking with Alan Mostoff about how I thought both the division would be bettered by the change if he moved over there, and I thought his career would be wonderful if he moved over there. That turned out to be true. He became director of the division.
It's interesting that you picked up on that one, because after you left, maybe 5 years later, there was another change, and they moved the disclosure operations back to the Division of Corporation Finance for 3 or 4 years, and then they were moved back to investment.
Really? I didn't know that.
I knew nothing. Well, I can't say I knew nothing about investment companies, because I worked as a vice president of a management company for a year, I was an associate director of Corp Fin, and they gave me the wonderful responsibility of supervising these people whose work I knew very little about. I was not unhappy to see them where they really belong.
They're not exciting registration statements for the most part.
Occasionally, though, when some new product came online, but looking at a registration statement for a variable annuity is not the way I want to
and
practice.
I imagine that there was no investment company, enforcement division, rather, in those days. I was an opponent of creating an investment and enforcement division. It came up regularly. Sure, every year it came up. And when it came up while I was there, I took the position that it was important to keep some enforcement capability, not centralized, but in each of the operating divisions, so that it was closer to the people who made the regulations and knew what was enforceable, what should be enforced, rather than taking a bunch of litigators and leaving them on their own, in part because litigators quite properly just want to win and they don't care how they win, and sometimes that's not a good idea. I was amused to see in this last week or so that after years of a division of enforcement separated from the divisions, I think Rod Hills did that, and I must say that the commission has been blessed with finding quite good enforcement directors who ran good divisions during all this period. But the current director has just announced that he is creating groups of enforcement people to work with each of the divisions, so that what I thought was missing will be replaced. So it's come full circle around.
Were there any amusing things that you recall that occurred while you were there without embarrassing any people, or at least the living?
Well, not kind of amusing, but things that I remember. I said that there are lots of friends in Washington and in other places, and they were occasionally useful. But one of the things that went on for a long time was conflict with IOS and Bernie Kornfeld, who ran a huge IOS was a huge investment company, Swiss-based enterprise called the Fund of Funds, which was an offshore fund which had in its portfolio United States regulated mutual funds, and there were always problems, regulatory problems. I remember a commission meeting. This may have been while Manny was away, at which a friend of mine was arguing on behalf of IOS. And I was giving him a little bit of a hard time with his argument. Barney Woodside realized that he was getting himself into trouble. He didn't need me to help him, get into trouble. And he passed me a note, which I think I preserved somewhere, which I treasured, on blue, green, SEC, notepaper, the little memo pad that they had. And it said, Lenny, West Virginia has, where Woodside lives, West Virginia has lots of rocks. We have a saying, leave them laying where Jesus flung. PDW, meaning leave him alone, he'll get into trouble by himself, and he did. But that eventually morphed into a big investigation by Court Gregg. I remember one day, one weekend, I got a telephone call saying that Alan Gordon, who was, I think, chief counsel of that division, was working on the investigation, was in Guam, and wanted to go to Japan, but could not get a flight for something like 4 or 5 days, and there was nothing to do in Guam for 4 or 5 days. Could I get him on a military plane to Tokyo? Well, one of my contemporaries worked in a staff position at the Pentagon. I found him, I called him up, I talked to him. John Stedman became a D.C. judge, actually. John, can you get this fellow on a plane? He said, I can, but the general who would do it is playing golf. Is it worth calling him on the golf course? Well, I appealed to his patriotism, I said, of course, it's your problem, but you don't want to sterilize an important official of this agency for the better part of a week. And he called, and he, by God, Gordon was on that military plane, I think, the next day, which was in Tokyo. Things like that were fun for me. Made the job a little more interesting. Another adventure for me was moving the commission, which occurred about midway. I probably finished toward the end of the 2 years. We had been in these little old temporary buildings, World War I temporary buildings, which were not bad because it was good to have Wall Street down there, all dressed up in the shabby old headquarters where all the power lay. But Manny convinced the powers that be that a move not to Potomac, Maryland, but to or wherever Maryland they wanted to move us, but rather to North Capitol Street would be a good thing to do. Bill Becker, who was very senior management staff person, was in charge of the move. It was a logistic job that I was really, from the chairman's office, and was responsible for, mostly making sure that we had a very good office for the chairman and his staff. The only wrinkle that I never did solve was that we had moved all filing desks down to the first floor, level below the first floor. In the old building, everything was open. People wandered the halls, journalists wandered the halls, messengers wandered the halls. There was no real control at all, and a desire to put some discipline into that. So everything that brought casual strangers into the building were confined to the ground floor and below. And access above that was more restricted. But the woman who ran the 33 Act firing desk claimed that was a function that was really a regulatory function because she screened every filing to make sure that it met the requirements. And that therefore she should be upstairs with the regulators on the fifth floor, was it? So that there would be immediate access to the powers that be if necessary. She took that position and nobody challenged her. I never found out what power she had, what body she knew were very rare, but nobody ever argued with her. when the new building opened up, she was up upstairs with everybody else, and it remained there until she retired, when it was probably moved down where it belonged, down with every other filing. Life in the bureaucracy.
And I remember that at times it used to get very crowded on the elevator because all the messengers would be taking their filings. There was no Edgar in those days. You just file everything on paper.
Now, we talked a lot about 33 Act registrations and the 1940 Investment Company and Advisors Act, but there was also market structure, which was didn't occupy quite as much attention as it is this year, but certainly occupied a lot of managed attention. The biggest market structure problems were Rule 394, which became 390, which required that all New York Stock Exchange members trade New York Stock Exchange listed stocks on the New York Stock Exchange, and which bothered people like Morris Shapiro, a bank stock over-the-counter dealer who was a non-New York Stock Exchange member, who was disadvantaged because I think it was Chase moved on to the New York Stock Exchange, and Don Whedon, Whedon and Company, who ran called a third market firm. He made markets in New York Stock Exchange listed stocks, even though he was not a New York Stock Exchange member. They were constantly badgering Manny to get rid of Rule 394, and there was also the problem of New York Stock Exchange fixed minimum commissions. Those commissions were required to be charged on every stock exchange, New York Stock Exchange listed trade by a New York Stock Exchange member. And they were too high. The fees were too high. You had a classic economic problem of like too rigid price structure that was overpriced, and so you got rebates immediately. And a really terrible practice called give-ups developed where a stock exchange firm would get an order, say an institutional order, which paid the same per share price as a 100 share trade per share, and the person, the institution giving the transaction, could say give up so much of the commission, that is transfer so much of the commission to any other New York Stock Exchange member.
I assume they were doing that because the other New York Stock Exchange member was selling fund shares or doing something to benefit the fund.
Well, that was the typical transaction.
Things haven't changed too much.
Well, in the IOS fund of funds business, IOS had a great deal of New York Stock Exchange business because they ran some funds of their own. And all of their give-ups went to a person who supposedly lived on an island in the Bahamas, was a registered representative with a New York Stock Exchange firm that never came to the United States, and all of the money got transferred to that broker's account the broker's share of that, and presumably didn't help the investment companies at all that went back to Cornfield. Well, those two things, which really had to be solved and eventually were, were the cause of a great deal of friction between Manny and the New York Stock Exchange, and on the one hand, and Whedon and Shapiro on the other. Shapiro was always saying that he had an antitrust lawyer in the car downstairs with the motor running, with the papers ready.
Change the tape.
So he was in the car with the papers ready to be served. I never knew whether that was true or not, but that was Morris Shapiro's line. And Manny, for my 2 years, spent those 2 years trying to reconcile these positions in some way, never did, and eventually helped force, I think, the New York Stock Exchange changes, too, particularly on the commissions. It took a long time to do, but it was quite painful. But that was a sample where his consensus building simply didn't work.
Were there other things during your 2 years there that are worth recalling?
Well, to me, they were a full 2 years. They went by very quickly.
It certainly sounds like that. It's both in terms of substance and in terms of administration. You certainly got involved in the administration.
I found to my surprise that I liked administration, so I didn't mind working on things like budget. Manny handled the budget very easily because he'd been doing it for a lot of years. But I found I enjoyed it. McNamara in the Department of Defense had developed a budgeting technique called Program Planning Budget, PPB. That was a way of budgeting not by simple numbers, but by deciding what it is you wanted to achieve and then budgeting to achieve that. In the Pentagon, it meant you don't just build a cruiser. You decide how much firepower you want and how much speed and how big it should be. And then you work backwards from that to the budget rather than simply building another cruiser. Something of a leap from that to the FTC, but the same principles applied. I thought that was pretty good, and I didn't particularly like the way the budget worked with the FTC because it was based on statistics that really didn't mean too much. It was how many investigations you opened and how many you closed and how many things you completed. And it didn't have any quality to them. It was simply numbers. So I'm striking out on my own. I made a date with the Bureau of the Budget Examiner, who was responsible for the SEC. Donovan must have been dying when he heard about it, but I made a lunch date with him. We had lunch, and I started talking about PPV and whether our yardsticks for the budget were, and the poor young man at budget was turning a little white as I did this, and I sensed his distress, and I finally got out of him that he had finally, after a long time, felt that the measures that he and Donnelly had worked out were the perfect measures for deciding what the SEC budget should be, and I retreated as fast as I knew how, changed the subject, and we had a pleasant lunch for the rest of it, and I never raised it again. The Bureau of the Budget did, however, present a program of PPB. And we were asked to send a representative for a year's training. Manny, he was stubborn about this. He insisted that this is nothing but an accounting problem and that an accountant should go. In fact, it had nothing to do with accounting. It was really budgeting. But Andy Barr must have found somebody who was interested in it, a nice guy. He went and he spent his year at the PPB school and enjoyed it. Came back as a budget expert.
Well, my time at the commission, I think we went through three different types of budgeting. I think PPB eventually was one of them, and then after that, whatever administration happened to be there, that their form of budgeting was used. But my experience was, still the numbers. Somehow, whatever the concept was, the end result was a bunch of numbers. We're going to do this many of these things this year.
Well, you could manipulate the numbers. I mean, you could open and close investigations fairly easily. But although, go back to Barney Woodside a little bit. Barney Woodside read everything. I don't know whether this was an explicit understanding Manny, but Woodside, who had a little bit of eye trouble, he would squint as he read, and I think it was a little awkward for him to read, but he read everything, and particularly requests for opening investigations and beginning proceedings, and it was common practice for a division engaged in one of those events, to have a very straightforward theory of why the investigation should be opened and what the legal theory was, but also to throw in a secondary one that could be a quite far-reaching novel interpretation, and it would just be slipped in as a secondary a justification for the investigation and proceeding, useful to be used as a threat with other people the next time around, or maybe even it would become a precedent that would be a main cause the next time. Woodside would hunt every one of those down and insist that when it came up to the commission that it be removed and only the established reason be given. We talked about accounting, the budget process and accounting. We haven't talked about Andy Barr, the chief accountant. I have to say that we have the only formal accounting training I had in law school, which I think was one of my lowest grades in law school. But I really did a lot of accounting in practice, working on registration statements. And I like accounting theory. I'm a terrible bookkeeper, but I like accounting theory. I used to talk with A. Barr, as he always signed himself, A. period Barr. One of the things that was happening during those 2 years was that conglomerates were becoming had become a favorite organizational device, and was Wall Street's current darling of the conglomerates. And there was some very funny accounting being developed. And I remember being asked by Barr if I would sit in a meeting where one major conglomerate out of California was doing something really strange. He asked me what I thought about it, and I said, "What about what?" He said, "That's what we think too." And they did, It was I really had a wonderful job. I wandered all over this commission, and I felt that I was doing something worthwhile. And I certainly enjoyed every second.
What ultimately influenced you to cut it short after 2 years?
Well, I had made a 2-year agreement with Nancy that I would do it for 2 years. That was my estimate of what it would take me to I would say achieve something, but do something meaningful. Manny urged me to stay, if not in that job, in some other job. And of course, Washington was always there. But I did not like the idea of having one client. So I didn't want to stay in Washington. I liked the diversity of practice. And I had a feeling, as far as the SEC was concerned, that I was getting a little bit jaded in the sense of accepting the SEC too much and the SEC's attitude and not being questioning. I was becoming co-opted by the commission and was therefore losing a little bit of my edge, and that it was time to go. Part of the permission to leave was contingent on finding a successor, which was easy because I had a little bit of contact with David Ratner, whom I knew from law school. The idea of somebody teaching David was at Cornell appealed to Manny, admired the scholar, and it was an easy transfer for me. I don't know that the relationship that I had with Manny was perhaps different because I was first, and the heart attack was a formative experience for both of us. I remained quite close to Manny for the rest of his life. We were in quite regular contact. He died in 1957. In 1958, the George Washington Law Review did a memorial issue to him. I wrote a little piece on that, which describes my feelings about Manny and my appraisal of him. I tried to reflect that here today, and it still holds true, I think. I thought he was a wonderful chairman.
Some would say that he was the best chairman that the SEC ever had. What some people would say, comparisons are invidious. Each chairman had his own times to deal with.
You asked about humorous. I don't know whether it's humorous, but it sort of reminds me again of the Texas Gulf Sulphur case. One day, Paul Mason and I were dispatched to a meeting of state. Paul Mason, I forget where he was at the commission, what division he was in.
Investment management or corporate regulation, whatever it was.
That's where it's certainly well done. Paul Mason and I were sent out to a meeting of state securities administrators in Phoenix to make sure that they adopted a uniform broker-dealer registration form. Every state had their own form, and that was deemed to be onerous, and the SEC wanted to help the industry. They did enough to... the industry thought to hurt them, that they should help them by fostering this uniform form. But we went out there and lobbied for a couple of days, and we had it absolutely solid at a vote that was to be taken at the last day after lunch. Well, at lunch that day, it was a Chicago lawyer that addressed the meeting, and I guess Texas Gulf Sulphur was still pretty new. He spoke on the Texas Gulf Sulphur case, which he analyzed as a device by the SEC to take the fraud jurisdiction away from the State Securities Commission and contain it within the complete control of the SEC. And he was a spellbinder. He convinced them that they should not do anything to help the SEC get control of anything, and they defeated the broker dealer form as a result. So Paul Mason and I went home went back to Washington. We decided to go back to Las Vegas. We spent a night in Las Vegas on the way home to calm our spirits a little bit. Things like that were fun, I must say.
Is there anything else that you want to tell us, or we can wind it up now?
Well, I suppose the only thing I would add is again the huge difference between then and now. It's how many years from 66 to 64 now? So 40 years. The size of transactions I mentioned before. There's a lot more delegation now to the staff. The role of the commission is a little bit different. Much, much more attention to market structure. The problems seem to be much, I won't say, there are huge accounting problems, and there are huge market structure problems, enforcement problems. But they're different from, substantively different problems from what we had now. I don't envy the current commissioners and the job they have, particularly without a chairman able to pull everybody together, or a set of commissioners who are willing to be pulled together. It's not an easy time for the SEC. I think I was there at a time and place that was just right for me, and I'm grateful for the opportunity.
Well, thank you. You've given us some important insights on an important error of the commission.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. And we are concluding at 3:20 p.m.